Welcome back to 73 Seconds.
Today we are joined by Khan Nguyen, whose mission is to eradicate gender-based violence, including domestic violence and sexual assault, especially for women and children across Asian American communities and beyond, through culturally competent services, community engagement, and advocacy. Pamela Rosales and Denise Huang, welcome to the podcast. Please tell listeners a little bit about yourselves.
Hi, everybody. We are so happy to be here. My name is Pamela Rosales. I am the Multilingual Advocacy Program Coordinator with Khan Nguyen. So I help supervise our multilingual advocates. I also do some community outreaching, presentations, and events with other Asian American-focused organizations. And then I'm also in charge of our volunteer engagement team.
Yeah, hi, everyone. This is Denise. I'm the Sexual Assault Program Specialist at Khan Nguyen. And we're a domestic violence agency, so in my capacity, a lot of my work is recognizing the differences, but also the overlaps between sexual and domestic violence, doing a bit of preventative education, community engagement, outreach, all of that fun stuff. So yeah, thank you so much for having us here today.
Yeah, awesome. So happy to have you here with us today. Kind of bouncing off that, let's hear more about the fun stuff, right? So tell us about Khan Nguyen, your locations that you have, the populations you serve, and the services you offer.
Yeah, so Khan Nguyen is a 30-year-old agency in the Chicago area. We have offices in Park Ridge as well as Chicago. So like I said, we're a domestic violence agency, but we also offer sexual assault and sexual violence services. We primarily serve the Asian American, and immigrant communities in the area. Obviously, we wouldn't turn our doors or turn our backs on anyone else, right? That's where our expertise lies. That's also where most of our staff are from, right? That's our background. Most of our community members, our supporters, our partners are also from those communities. And in terms of services, we offer direct services, which includes a hotline. So that's a multilingual hotline. And among our staff, we have Japanese speakers, Spanish, Korean, Mandarin Chinese, Cantonese Chinese. And we also have access to a multilingual hotline. And then we also offer legal advocacy, transitional housing program, emergency shelter referrals, case management, counseling, right? The typical offerings of direct service. And on top of that, you know, since Pam and I are from the community engagement team, we have to give a special plug onto community engagement and the work that our team has been doing, right? So that's like volunteering, outreach, that's preventative education, workshops, podcasts like this.
So much.
Yeah.
So we just talked about the populations you serve and how a majority of your staff are from the Asian population. So we kind of want to turn the conversation and ask, how has the recent increase in violence toward Asian Americans affected your services or even affected your clients? How are you kind of seeing that in them today?
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to our direct services, we actually have not seen a dramatic spike or increase with our direct services stuff. So like the hotline, intakes, counseling sessions, clients in our transitional housing program and counseling sessions or case management, there hasn't been a dramatic increase from prior to the shooting to after the shooting. However, we have seen an increase in our community engagement aspect of things. So for example, even something like this podcast, we've also been asked to do workshops on the history of Asian American women and gender-based violence. So, you know, getting requests from different organizations, even those who are not Asian focused, for us to come in and speak about that, the intersectionalities of both. And then we've also been getting a lot of inquiries from volunteers to help in the community engagement side of things. And on top of that, we've also been getting a lot of media requests to come in and do, like, be interviewed or show up in the news, which Denise was part of. yeah. And then also, like, kind of in that same realm, we've been getting asked for somebody, like a representative from Khan Nguyen, to come in and speak to the organization or to an organization where there is, like, membership to speak on the issues and intersectionalities of Asian women and gender-based violence as it pertains to the Atlanta shooting. So I think what that represents, the fact that there hasn't been a significant increase in direct service issues, but there has been a spike in community engagement, shows that since the Atlanta shooting, what it really has done is lift a veil for non-Asian Americans to see the issues that Asian women have been experiencing in this country for not just since the shooting, but for decades. It has lifted the veil for people to realize the racialized misogyny that is very much unique with Asian American women. And I feel like the reason why we haven't been experiencing a spike in hotline calls is because Asian American women, we've been experiencing this. Thankfully, Khan Nguyen has been prepared since the creation of this organization to serve this. You know, so when all of these requests started happening, it kind of was natural for us to step in because we already had the tools that we needed because we have been discussing these issues for such a long time. It's more so the rest of the country to finally get on track with the things that we have been trying to say and trying to push for and having that platform to speak on these things for such a long time. So that's kind of the difference. And that's what's been happening with Khan Nguyen in terms of how this has affected our services. It's really the community engagement side of things and just spreading awareness of what Asian American women have been going through and our unique barriers when it comes to dealing with and leaving a violent situation.
Mm-hmm. Can I also add something? I'll also say that, like, aside from like the shootings, right, like in general, there's been a lot of news coverage, right, on this violence. And obviously this violence has been happening prior to the news coverage, right? And so I think this like increased spotlight is also, it's creating kind of like a climate, right, of like fear or anxiety, worry, right? And a lot of clients have just, you know, over the year of COVID, they've been saying like, oh, I'm like scared to go to the store, right? Or like I've been noticing like some more harassment that has like more racial overtones, right? Not even undertones, like overtones. It's very overt, right? And I don't know if, you know, like Pema said, this has been going on for like a really, really long time, right? But like this increased spotlight, the intensity of that, of this spotlight has maybe given our community like a feeling of more like legitimacy to like vocalize these concerns, right? I mean, it's hard to say. We can't say that there's any correlation. We don't know how we can like isolate that, those variables, right? But like definitely at least like people are talking about it more, and like we don't know why, but they are, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks, Denise. And yeah, to just go off of that, the events in Atlanta has been both kind of bittersweet, even just on an individual level, but even for survivors who are Asian women and Asian femmes, that it's finally this validation, this recognition from non-Asians, but throughout the country, that we are people of color, that we experience racism, that we experience racialized misogyny. It's been overwhelming to see the united support. However, a year ago when the pandemic hit and all of this xenophobic language was coming out from the government, from the media, honestly, even in my own personal circles, Asian Americans knew what was going to happen. We saw the wave before the tsunami hit, essentially. Even within Asian news media, we were already seeing reports of anti-Asian hate attacks, hate crimes being happening. And so when Atlanta happened, it was more finally something that can come out for other non-Asians to see what we have been experiencing and what we have been trying to say since the beginning of the pandemic and even before that. And even amongst the increased hate crimes with Asian Americans, 68% of that have been done to Asian women. So when hate crimes exist, the most vulnerable get the most attacks, and that is Asian American women, children, and elderly. If anything, kind of to go to the initial question, what this has done is just created more barriers for Asian American survivors, those who are dealing with domestic violence, to go out and seek services or to seek support because they're scared, you know, perhaps the agency that they're going to call might have those anti-Asian sentiments or have those bias come out. And it's hard to be a victim of domestic violence yet have to defend your culture at the same time. So this is all very complex, but all simple to boil down that this event is really more like a lifting of the veil for non-Asians to see and finally recognize what Asian women have been going through and what we have been saying for such a long time.
So as I'm listening, I'm hearing like it's almost a double-edged sword, right? Because you're getting all this really good information and disseminating that out into the community, right? The news and media is really kind of like helping in that aspect with the engagement piece. But then at the same time, then there's this vulnerable population that is experiencing an uptick in violence. Mm-hmm. Am I kind of like hearing that right?
Yes, that's a perfect way to put it, a double-edged sword, because it's not like the situation has gotten better. There's still hate crimes going on. Asian women are still being attacked with that added stress of sexual violence when it comes to these attacks. So yes, people are finally getting on board and are kind of playing catch up, you know, like trying to learn all about Asian American history, and that is great. But yeah, as the country is kind of catching up on learning about Asian American history, Asian American women and other vulnerable groups in our community are still experiencing that violence.
Yeah. I think one of the things, as Sarah and I are both therapists by training, and I just think back to all of the cultural competency language that we have to learn and we really have to work on, right? And the fact that we may be learning about that or actively working on those items, right? But the country is behind us on that, right? Like we have done some of that work, right? And we're actively working on those things, but the country is a lot slower in its motion, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like we've been talking about, the past year has been really tumultuous, and definitely here at Z Center, we've been discussing how do we actively work to promote, right, racial justice, social justice. We need to be more involved in things like police trainings, local activism, outreach to vulnerable communities. How have you kind of evolved your services, or how have you utilized the outreach and the engagement pieces to really work through all these changes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. Yeah, I mean, I think going off of what you were saying about like the cultural competency piece, right? I think, you know, Kanwin being our origins is like a Korean American organization, right? But now we're more Asian and immigrant focused. And so, you know, we also have a lot of work to do as well. So we definitely don't speak for everybody, or we don't speak for every Asian out there. But, you know, we've been trying to be that liaison, right, of that like cultural competency piece. You know, the training that we get, our lived experiences as, you know, our entire staff is Asian, right? So, you know, that liaison, right, to our community members, you know, some of our community members are Asian, some are not. And so we try to be that liaison. You know, when it comes to cultural competency, it's not like, I feel like Pam and I have been scratching our heads about like, what does that really mean, right? Like, what is cultural competency? Obviously, one can never be fully competent in someone else's culture. And on top of that, like when it comes to providing services or providing education, I'm still always kind of like confused as to like what's the culture part of it, right? Because for me, a lot of it is historical and political, right? And social as well. And I think sometimes when we say cultural, it's kind of like sugarcoating those terms, right? Like the social, the political, the historical, because those are more like, those are trickier, right? Those are like the trickier factors, and the things that are, you know, those are kind of the hard pills to swallow, right? It kind of involves everyone's complicity, or it kind of requires a lot more introspection. I would just say like, it's just like a harder work, right? But you know, the reality is like, if we see the scale and the magnitude of the violence that's happening, that should be the route we're taking, right? We should be doing cultural competency that has teeth, right? It should be, you know, like where does like the intergenerational trauma, for example, come from, right? Well, for a lot of Asian communities, intergenerational trauma comes from war and migration, right? And like a lot of those wars and migration channels have been, you know, like it involves American power and American politics, right? It's very hard to talk about. It's very to talk about publicly, right? But this is like what we're talking about behind closed doors for sure, right? So as advocates, as educators, when we're doing this cultural competency work, we should be giving our community members that language, that framework, right? To show that we understand like truthfully, like genuinely where this trauma can originate from, right? I think as anti-violence workers, we know that, you know, violence is not isolated. It's not individual. It's a system, right? So when we talk about the system, we have to be consistent, right? With that use of the word system, we have to see that this violence is, it goes into so many different domains, right? It's like I said, like it's historical, it's political. And to, you know, not use that language to dance around it is pretty disingenuous, right, Pam? Like it's pretty, mm-hmm. like, you know, Pam and I, I'm Chinese, Pam is
Filipino.
So we talk about it, right? We talk about how like, our political histories, our identities as Asian Americans, as Chinese Americans, Filipino American, like that has political weight, right? And when we're doing services with survivors in our respective communities, we have to acknowledge that history. We can't just like, we can't just like, you know, wink, wink about it, right? We have to like overtly, explicitly label it, be specific, right? I think that's another thing that we've noticed, like in this year of violence, like let's be specific about what this is, right? This is xenophobia, this is anti-Asian racism, this is Sinophobia, like there, Orientalism, fetishization, hypersexualization, like all these terms, right? Like perhaps for some listeners, these might be new terms, but I will say it's not jargon for us, right? This is like the words that actually make sense to us as Asian women, right? And for a lot of our clients, like, right? And so it is, you know, important to like use these uses language and not be shy about it.
I just really love the term like historical competency, right? Or political competency. I mean, we talk about these things, right? And I think in, yeah, like you said, in our circles, we have these conversations that are very real. And we have hard conversations as a group, as an organization, right? With other organizations like yourselves. But yeah, I think having that context is so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah, no, I agree too. I was just thinking, I'm preparing like a blog post for Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, right?
Yeah.
And as I was doing that and preparing it, I'm realizing like that's a history that like I don't have a lot of knowledge for, mm-hmm. right? And when we're doing the Black History Month, that's also one where like I dove in deep and like learned a lot more. And I think it's really important that we are doing those deep dives into these communities to people of color, including the Asian community, to have that understanding, to know where this is all coming from and to learn like the important historical figures and how it's gotten us to where we are and how we can break this cycle that we are so clearly in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And if we don't know history, like, I mean, that's such like an outdated cliched quote, right? But like, we're totally doomed to repeat it. And I think we're kind of seeing that in so many ways. And if people want to call themselves, and I've just been saying this like over and over in the past week, like, but if people want to be social justice activists, like you have to activate in times of social justice. Like, and these are those times, right? And having an uncomfortable and very vulnerable conversation, I think people still don't like to use the word vulnerability, and you have to get vulnerable. You have to be open about like where you come from, the biases you have, the unknown, and you have to sit there in that level of discomfort, right, with that. So yeah, I really love that we're having this conversation.
Yeah, I think what I would like to see more in cultural competency trainings, workshops, courses, because I've most of my work in the DV essay realm has been through training, specifically the essay and DV training, is really naming systems, like what Denise was talking about. How are we going to dismantle the system, which is white supremacy, mm-hmm. white privilege, cishet privilege, that affects the most vulnerable in our communities? Because when you're looking at issues that Asian American women face, that Black women face, that Latinx women face, et cetera, the main denominator there is white supremacy. And I do see, and I have experienced a hesitancy of, you know, it's fun to learn about cultures. It's fun, you know, me as an Asian woman, me as a Muslim woman, I don't really care if you learn how to cook fried rice. I don't need you to be culturally competent on the fun things when yeah. systemically you're participating in a system that is harming my community, you know? And that includes even in the workspace of labeling women of color as combative, as extreme, when we are expressing how we believe this program can improve, not promoting Asian women into leadership roles. These are the things that I wish that cultural competency trainings can really focus on, as opposed to kind of like the fluffy things that is kind of, I feel, is reduced in cultural competency trainings, kind of saying like, oh, just experience, like, what is that saying where they're like, imagine if you were in their shoes, like that really doesn't do anything because you don't unless you've come with the racialized experience of being an Asian woman, of being a Black woman, of being a hijabi woman, you're never going to understand, even if you wore my shoes. You know what I'm saying? So that is definitely a critique I would have with cultural competency. And, you know, people, when we talk about history, especially, well, with any women of color, with any demographic, but especially with Asian Americans, we have to look at US imperialism. We have to look at World War II. The comfort women issue did not start just by itself. It was because of World War II. And we need to look at the sexual violence committed by the US military and how the Visiting Forces Agreement Act still continues today. There are still US military bases in Asia today, even in the Philippines, my home country. And the fact, when it comes to the biggest threat to sexual violence to civilians, it is the contact between Asian women and US military forces. If there's a base there, the rate of sexual violence increases. And that's happening today. And I think a lot of times, especially with like millennials and Gen Zs, and also maybe Gen X, is like, they think about war or they think about slavery. They think it's like so far-fetched. It's too far back. But realistically speaking, that's our grandparents and potentially our parents. My grandma was under US and Japanese occupation. That's the legacy my people have. And that's the issues that we had to carry, the generational trauma that we had to endure when we came to this country. Same thing with Southeast Asians and same thing right now in the Middle East. So history is so crucial. We, in order to be advocates and to really be committed into anti-racism and serving other communities, we have to look at how US politics really destabilized these areas, these regions, and how sexual violence was a huge part of that, and what that trauma looks like to families, to women and their conceptualization of the self, and how it is when they're working, when they find their own partners and stuff. So I just wanted to add that to the conversation because, yeah, history is so crucial when we're looking at Asian American sexual violence against women.
Yeah, I echo that, Pam, 100%.
Yeah, I was going to say too, that when you were talking, my thought process, right, was this top level cultural competency is it almost seems like, right, a form of like appropriation, right? When you're talking about learn my culture, okay, here's how to make fried rice, here's how to do this. That's not cultural competency, right? In order to reach that, you do need to do that deeper dive to get the understanding of the intersectionality and how imperialism has played into that and continues to this day. And literally, I mean, everything you've said, right? That is having that cultural competency, is doing that dive deep and not just staying in the surface level of appropriation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I kind of even like don't want to like move on from this topic. Like I want to keep talking about this, even though like we have other topics planned, but we could move on,
even just to piggyback off of what Pam was saying, you know, like sexual violence in general is not like a, you know, one-dimensional issue, right? Like we know it's a system, right? Between the four of us here, we know it's a system. But you know, when we're talking about system, we have to be very, very, very broad. We have to include all the different dimensions and the prongs, including imperialism, ableism, classism, all the like isms that kind of like get put on the back burner sometimes, right? Like the things that like, oh, like I'm not versed to talk about that, or like, oh, like, you know, I, you know, whatever, XYZ excuse. But, you know, like we are all a work in progress. None of us are perfect. None of us are some, you know, God on earth where we know everything, right? We, especially as advocates, we should be in this position where we're constantly reflecting on our own biases, constantly reflecting on our own positionalities and figuring out like, well, I'm here to support this survivor and, you know, empower them to make their best decisions. But at the same time, you know, clients and survivors are not perfect either. Sometimes there is some, you know, bias or some racism coming through, and it's like, well, how do I, as an advocate, is it my job to like step in, you know, that sort of thing. And I think for me, that's like the hard part, right? Like recognizing that, you know, sexual violence, domestic violence, gender-based violence is not like a one band-aid job, right? It's a whole comprehensive thing that we need to tackle. But how do I get people to see that, right? Like, how do I, you know, like it's like a juggling act, right? It's especially for me, like, it was also a cliche kind of, right? But like personal is political, right? So, you know, for me as an Asian American woman, like I can't do like colorblind sexual violence work. You know, I can't. It's just not genuine. It's also traumatic for me. It's, you know, it's not my best self, right? To say the least. And so that's the hardest part. How much of myself do I bring into this? And, you know, recognizing that that can lead to burnout, that can lead to a lot of vulnerability, modeling vulnerability. But at the same time, like, that's what I envision for the field. And that's what I envision for my coworkers to have as well. So I do it, even though it's like really hard, but you know, it's what I imagine for survivors and for my fellow advocates.
Thanks, Denise, for that. And I think my answer to that question is similar in terms of burnout of, you know, how do we keep this going? Because it isn't sustainable to only engage a minority group when there is a crisis, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, because now we are getting a lot of coverage on this issue, and that's great. My fear, which I feel like we all know what the answer will be because it's a common theme where it's just a trend for a moment and then next year it's completely forgotten. How my hardest thing is trying to figure out how do we continue centering and including Asian American women in the anti-violence movement alongside Black women, Latinx women, Indigenous women, and other vulnerable communities. That's the biggest thing for me, because, you know, it is a lot right now. And I think as a community, as an Asian community, for Asian women especially, we're going through a trauma. We're going through a grieving process. And it was during this time where we were getting bombarded with a lot of like community engagement stuff, which, you know, on one hand, like you had said earlier, that double-edged sword, like, of course, that is super important for us. We need to talk. And I'm so glad that we had the tools and presentations and everything ready, workshops ready on hand for this. We weren't starting from scratch either. So I'm really glad. And that's kind of something I'm very proud of with Kenwin. But at the same time, especially, you know, thinking about the people, even the executive director of not only Kenwin, but the other Asian focused organizations in Chicago, to have to go in front of the news and to have to, you know, lead these vigils and lead these protests, you know, how much energy that took from them alongside having to grieve. And so that is the hardest thing for me right now, is the limelight is on us. And how long of a window do we have to get our point across, and are we getting it across? And I know that's not fair, and I wish it wasn't that way, but that's my issue right now.
Yeah, I just want to echo that again. Like, I think especially since it is like Asian AAPI Heritage Month, well, Pam and I were making a joke about how like, we kind of forget that it's AAPI Heritage Month, because like for us, obviously, it's every month of the year. But we were thinking like, yeah, like as it turns out, you know, AAPI Heritage Month is in May, and you know, with the Georgia shootings, that was like kind of a peak in the crisis, like a peak crisis point, right? So it's like a few months before May. But like, what if, you know, our Heritage Month were in December? You know, like, would this energy still be here? You know, like, would people still have the focus, this dedication, and this interest in supporting the Asian American community, you know, a year later after this like crisis point that like, you know, hit the media, you know, the Georgia shootings? So that piece about sustainability is just like, it's hard. I don't even know how to elaborate on it. It's just really hard.
Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people, I think, do go through this cycle, especially the media, right? Where things are popular, this is a trend to be an activist about around this issue. And then after a few weeks, it goes down and it's something else, and it goes in waves. But I think the important work that we're talking about here is eCenter is like, this is lifelong, right? Mm-hmm. Getting this anti-racist perspective and an understanding to end violence, it can't go in waves like that. It can't be, oh, we support Black Lives Matter during Black History Month, or, oh, we support Asian communities during AAPI Month. It's a continuous lifelong cycle. I think the important thing is the agencies like Z-Center, where we are a lot of white women, need to recognize that and continue to do the work so that we can support the community of colors and women of color who are always continuously doing this work and are also experiencing the racism that's entwined with the work that we're doing.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the miracle question, if tomorrow you woke up and you had one miracle that would happen, one thing that you could change and would change permanently when you woke up, what would that one thing be? How would the world look differently?
I think for me, the miracle, and yeah, and this is kind of still within the framework that these systems of oppression still exist and anti-violence still exists. Yeah, which would be kind of what I have been discussing already is that Asian women are continued to be centered. This energy right now is continued and prolonged, and that agencies like Can Win and Apnagar and Hana Center that are, you know, specific Asian focused DV centers in Chicago, that the burden can be lifted off of them from other agencies throughout Illinois who have done the work in learning about anti-Asian sentiments, how gender-based violence and the intersections between that and Asian women, the Asian women experience. So that, you know, let's say a DV center in Decatur got a, you know, crisis call from a Chinese or Asian woman in their community, they don't just automatically give it to Can Win. That they know what they can do, they know how they can react, they know how to work the language line. We don't need you to be, you know, fully to speak the language. And then that is great, because that does bring that cultural aspect. But as an ally right now, there are a lot of things that agencies can do, learning how to use the language line, knowing what your biases are when it comes to people that have accents, and knowing how to be patient with them. Because guess what? Kids of immigrants have learned to do that when they were young. When we came into this country, we've been translating. Like, if kids can do it, grown adults with licenses can do it, okay? Yeah. Right? Like, understanding that immigrant experience, because while we, Can Win does have, you know, clients from outside of Chicago, and, you know, we are absolutely happy and ready to serve, but the best people to serve are those in your community. And yeah, maybe you don't share the same racial experience, but you know the resources and you have the connections as an agency to help that individual, regardless of their race, regardless of their documentation status. So put that effort in. The effort isn't, oh, let me just forward you to Hana Center, let me just forward you to Can Win. You know, do that work now. And that's hopefully, you know, the action call that people can take away from this is learning those things and learning to be intersectional when it comes to looking at the different resources your community provides. That would be my thing, my miracle wand.
I love that.
Yeah. I feel like it almost kind of answers like the next question that I had too, because we're kind of talking about how do we do better as a society, right? How do we do better as people of privilege, right? And how do we work through these really difficult things? And I mean, I'm going to ask the question anyway, but you know, we could take it anywhere we want to, but how can people who aren't actively in this work right now, how can they start that work? What would you suggest? And I just totally threw you off. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's such a big question, right? And, you know, I never like prescriptive answers, but like, you know, I'm going to force myself to think that way. I think for like one thing, it's going back to like the idea of being like specific, right? Like AAPI is Asian American Pacific Islander. Like, oh gosh, like it's, we need to like break that down, right? Like there's already so much contention and difference within Asian American itself, right? Like with like ethnically, right? Like, you know, like I said, like Pam's Filipino, I'm Chinese, like we are not the same. Like we have some similarities, but we're not the same. I have much to learn from Pam and vice versa, mm-hmm. right? So already that's complicated, right? So when you throw in Pacific Islander who are regularly just being seen as like the footnote, right? It's like the Asian American community needs to like own up to that, right? Like we, like, yeah, AAPI looks really great. Like it's nice and short, right? Fits on a grant, right? I know it fits on a grant, but like, it's not specific. And you can't tokenize or like just cherry pick information so that it looks good, right? So that it looks like you're doing more work than you're actually doing, right? This is not like, being an advocate is not some noble pursuit, right? It's something that we actually want to do, right? We actually want to support survivors. We actually want to end gender-based violence, like all that stuff. It's not an ends to a means, you know, like, or means to an end, right? Like you can't just be like, oh, like we also serve, you know, with cultural competency and like expertise, Pacific Islander communities, right? You know, like if that's the conversation that Asian Americans are having, I think for allies, it's also very important to be specific, right? And to follow that lead, right? And to say, you know, to recognize the difference even between like Chinese and Korean, right? Pam over here is laughing. Right, but it is very difficult. But like, you know, Asian American is a political identity. That's something, I'm not going to do a history lesson right now, but it is something that was created, you know, what was it, 60s or 70s, right? It was a movement, it was an Asian American movement to, you know, create this identity in order to create this unity or like some kind of commonality, right, among all these groups that were coming from the quote Asian continent, right? Whatever that means, right? But you know, like back in Asia, like Asian doesn't have traction, right? It's Chinese, Korean, Japanese, you know, all that kind of stuff. And there's inter-ethnic conflict, and that conflict carries over into the US, right? You don't just leave your traumas or your baggage at the door when you come into the States, right? Like that is something that is transmitted, whether overtly said and told, you know, from grandparent to child and so on, or by omission, right? You kind of get a sense of that sort of tension and that trauma that is not being addressed. Because, you know, like Pam had said, like, you know, Japanese occupation in the Philippines, right? Not just American occupation. So anyway, so that's all to say that it's a lot more complicated. It's very complicated for allies to step into this. It's very complicated. So when you're doing this work, it's so important not to be fragile and to not be like awkward about being the numerical minority in the room when we're talking about Asian-centered things or whatever, right? When we're doing that work. So, yeah, I mean, it's not really a prescriptive answer, I suppose, but it's just kind of like some more context for the allies who want to step into this.
Mm-hmm. Allyship. So I guess for me, what would it look like? And yeah, it is very much different for each individual, let alone each community. And even with allyship, I have to think about, you know, how can I, as an Asian American woman, be an ally to other minoritized groups in solidarity? And I'm sure, you know, there's things that me and also my community that we can do to improve, you know, uplifting Black and Latinx and Indigenous women's voices, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. But when it comes to kind of like the bigger, like racial, like things, allyship for me would be to allyship specifically when it comes to whiteness and white people and white women. Again, what Denise was talking about earlier is the importance of specificity. So with regards to allyship in that regard, it would be to let us speak and not co-opt the movement, as we've seen with the sexual violence movement, how Me Too, hashtag Me Too was co-opted by white women when it was created by Tarana Burke to serve her community in Brooklyn. And that would be one thing. And I have seen almost that co-optation happen within this movement, and forgetting the gendered piece that these anti-Asian hate crimes has brought and how it's doubling down on Asian women. But anyway, so that's what I would want. I mean, again, like what Denise said, I don't have a prescriptive answer that can like fix it, but just knowing how much privilege carries in a room, and that sometimes even being present in a room where it's supposed to center a minoritized group that you do not have any identity with, your presence alone can completely shift that dynamic. And so being respectful of that, and also just sitting and being quiet and listening and sitting with those hard feelings, I guess, would be the first step that I would like. Yeah, this is hard. But I think what I would like more is people that have that privilege, white privilege, to look amongst within their communities and ask themselves, you know, what are books that we can be reading, as opposed to like having, you know, because there are already members of all communities who have done that work of showing like, what does allyship look like? How can you be an ally for this issue and this cause, et cetera? And so it really is upon the allies' job to do that research.
Can I also add something? Because you had mentioned like with the hate crimes and all of that, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's another thing that is like, that's like the piece where I think the hate crimes, the federal hate crime bill, which was just signed by Biden yesterday, I mean, you know, if anyone who follows American politics knows, it's very hard to get a unanimous bill or like a pretty like, you know, highly supported bill signed and all that. And it was pretty fast too, right? You know, as someone who's politically aware, politically minded, and, you know, generally very skeptical of the system, that should be like a billion red flags going off. Like, what is that about? Like co-optation, the riding on the momentum and the pain of our community to pass a hate crime bill that we know is, that's language and that's like increased state surveillance and monitoring and punitive measures that's probably going to land on Black and brown communities, right? And I think something that the Asian American community has been wrestling with over the past year is how our safety cannot result in the endangerment of Black and brown communities. And especially when you look at the, you know, a lot of the Asian individuals who have been in the news, you know, like the footage of them being beaten or, you know, all these like really awful things. It's generally been women and elderly, right? Or people who are in Chinatowns or, you know, kind of, you know, it's like working class communities or folks who might be immigrants, people who might be seen already as being vulnerable, who can't stand up against this assailant, right? And as we know in the anti-violence movement, you know, aggressors will often target people who they know like will not speak up, right? Or who won't retaliate against them, right? So applying that framework in here. And so that's all to say that basically these are measures that are being pushed by, you know, we see a lot of like Asian celebrities or like Asians who are not in, who are not living in these communities pushing for things like increased police patrols or whatnot. And it's like, you know, you aren't embedded in these communities. You don't realize that increased police presence in these communities will lead to a chilling effect. You know, you don't realize that, you know, for folks who might be in sex work, people who are doing under the table work, you know, or who are undocumented, to have increased police presence or, you know, to have like that sort of monitoring is not going to lead to like a better life for them, right? It's going to put them into a state of frenzy, a state in which they might be more wary to reach out, a state in which they might not want to be noticed, right? And, you know, that's going to increase isolation. That's going to just basically put them in a condition where, you know, they are more vulnerable to violence, right? Interpersonal violence, as well as state violence, right? And that's so important to realize that there is a huge connection between interpersonal and state violence. Like, that, I mean, I could just go on about that. That's a different podcast.
I think that that's really important too, because that kind of talks to using broad terms to describe something, right? Like, mm-hmm. So this broad term might be, you know, like if we say AAPI, right? Like that might like encapsulate something, but it's not realistic, right? It doesn't take into account all of these other things. And if we're talking about like, oh, this hate crime, right? Like we're working to reduce hate, but you're not really getting the picture. Like that's not really what's going on here.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, yeah, with these, you know, the violence against Asians recently, obviously it is driven in part by hate, but like at the same time, like how does one be held accountable for hate? How does one like provide empirical evidence of hate? Like instead, we should be gesturing towards the system, right? We see very concrete evidence of the system, right? Of white supremacy at play, right? Of xenophobia, right? Of racism. Like, yeah, let's be
specific. Just that just thinking about, right, another podcast, obviously, but like the reality that like the elected officials don't accurately represent the makeup of our population. Like, that's just not true, right? And if we think of it just in terms of gender, right, it's a 50-50 split population-wise, and only 20% of us are represented in elected seats, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, just thinking about that and how much less power we get in those decision-making abilities and what the impact of that is, right? And that's just gender, not taking into account all the other possibilities.
Mm-hmm. And I think just thinking about that allyship question, another, maybe one concrete thing I can give for allies, specifically with regards to Asian Americans, is to really learn about model minority myth and really dissect that. Because what we're seeing in this hate crime bill is the model minority myth being played at a systemic level. You are using, co-opting the Asian American struggle right now, and they're using that to police and criminalize Black and brown people even more. And even personally, I feel frustrated with that bill because that's how it feels like. My issues are being taken advantage of so that Black and brown people can get locked up. Because even the Atlanta shooting itself wasn't even labeled as a hate crime. But when it comes, if the perpetrator is a Black or Brown person, it's very easy for them to say, for the police to call it a hate crime. So to be, for allies to be critical of the model minority myth and how they maybe, you know, even reflect internally, how have they used Asians to pit other groups against each other, primarily against Black people, because that has been a big experience with Asian Americans, that we have been used as puppets by white supremacy to say, oh, look, you know, if Asian Americans can do this, then Black and Brown people, what's going on? Even though, you know, as allies, please look into the shortcomings and the failings of the model minority myth and how it does not encapsulate the entire Asian American experience, to say that, oh, Asian people, you know, they are the model minority and they are not POC because, you know, they on average make more than the average American. Like, really dissect that. Who's benefiting from that limited knowledge, and learn more about Southeast Asian refugees and the income that Southeast Asian and Native and Pacific Islanders have. And you're going to see a completely different story. They are also criminalized as well, but we're not included in that conversation because mm-hmm. the model minority myth only focuses on the elite. That's just not fair.
That's so much. I really appreciate you both sharing all of that, because mm-hmm. I think about this in the context of privilege, right? And that you could have the best of intentions. That doesn't mean that you're not doing a lot of harm, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really having to know, like, what are the ramifications of this? Like, you could have a great intention, but if it's not going to actually do something that's beneficial, then maybe we need to rethink that. We need to look at that in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I want to keep having this conversation, but I know that like we're on a time crunch,
right? We are.
Which doesn't mean that we can't have like another part two later. I mean, we can totally do that. Great. I mean, we have to keep the momentum going, right? Like, yeah, that's what we have to do. So, to kind of like wrap up, I wanted to ask, like, are there new like coalitions, events, things that you're involved in that other people should know about?
Yeah, I mean, I just have one event to plug. I think Pam has a few more, has a few things to say. But like Pam had said earlier, the Comfort Women issue, that's a huge pillar of our advocacy work as well. Basically, the Comfort Women issue is, it's militarized sexual slavery during World War II by the Imperial Japanese Army. There's an ongoing movement to get survivor justice. I won't go too much into it, but basically we are having a art show with Awakenings Gallery in Ravenswood, and it'll be featuring artwork by the survivors that they created during art therapy sessions, which is really amazing. I've already seen the booklet. It is very poignant, stirring, and just I'm very excited. And then we'll also be showing the Sanyo Song, which is the Statue of Peace. That's a huge symbol of the movement for survivor justice as well. And that will be opening on June 19th until early December. So it'd be really great for folks to come out. It's in person as well as virtually, right? So yeah, and we'll have a lot of programming during the summer as well. You know, mixed media events and panels and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, that's my plug.
Me, Meher from The Network, and Radhika from Apnagar, we all created a 90-minute training on racialized misogyny, specifically focusing on Asian American women and the Asian American experience. We actually started that training yesterday. And so what we did was we created this training in the hopes that it'll be distributed to other agencies within the network, and also potentially do the training with other agencies as well that isn't part of the network or isn't just focused on DV. And the training is going to be focusing on the global oppression, specifically U.S. imperialism in the Southeast and East Asia, as well as what's going on currently in the Middle East, because like what we talked about, it's really crucial to understand that history, specifically the sexual violence caused by imperialism and colonization, in understanding the roots of the harmful stereotypes and fetishization of Asian American women and our experiences here and throughout the diaspora. So if you are interested in learning more about that or attending one of the network's trainings to go through that training, please contact me. My email is prosal es@conwin.org, prosalis@conwin.org.
Awesome, thank you. The whole time you were describing it the first and the second time, I was thinking that's something that we would definitely want to reach out to you about. So.
Awesome, for sure.
I want to take it too. Okay. Yeah. I'll brush up on my knowledge, you know.
Yeah, let's go.
So we've talked about a lot today, right?
Yes,
we've
done
a
couple of times. So much.
So this might be a hard question, but I think it will be an important one to end with. What is the number one thing that you would want listeners to take away from our time together this past like 45 minutes to an hour that we've had?
Ooh, another very big question. Yeah, I mean, yeah, we've talked so much today, right? And, you know, we kind of just like dipped our toes into like all the different topic areas of you know, doing gender-based violence work and anti-Asian violence, and all the systems that we're up against, right? But I think like one of the biggest takeaways, right, kind of goes back to one of the earlier questions about what's the hardest part of the work, right? And I realized like when I said the hardest part of the work is like getting to like convince people to see sexual violence as a multi-dimensional issue, like I can't do that alone, right? It's something that requires collaboration, requires tag teaming. It's like a team effort, right? It goes without saying, but at the same time, like as an advocate, as an educator who does this work, it's really jaded, right? And it's like, when you feel like the weight of the world is on your own shoulders alone, like you can't help but come out and clock out at 5 and be like, oh, you know what? I might just call out sick tomorrow because I'm just so tired, right? But basically what I'm saying is I really want listeners to realize that for Asian American survivors, for Asian American advocates, right, for our community, those isms that we're talking about, right, like the classism, the racism, but especially imperialism and colonialization and that really dark history, but also it's ongoing, right? So I don't want to just say it's history, but it's like our current state, right? Like that is really, really important. I know that is not something that American education system will like readily talk about because, you know, for a variety of reasons, but like, you know, we all have our own journeys and it's really important for us today, if not yesterday, if today, at least to start realizing that imperialism, militarization, war, all those things, like Pam was saying, it's like our grandparents, like my grandma was alive during that time, you know what I mean? And like, she raised me, like what sort of trauma did she like exhibit, or like was she going through, was she processing when she, you know, was like feeding me dinner or whatever, you know, like these small things that we can't take for granted, like what was at play internally for her, you know, like those are important things that have impacted me and I'll just never know until we all are on the same page about how imperialism and war and occupation are, you know, huge causes of violence, right, and trauma for Asian women. So you know, it's just one thing to, you know, get yourself acquainted with that ism, with that system of oppression. And I think after you have that, everything else we've been talking about today should kind of fall in neatly, right? Fall in neatly from behind. So, I don't know, Pam, what about you?
That was really good.
I mean, I don't know. I'm just
but I follow that.
I'm riffing.
I love it. But honestly, it's pretty much along the same lines. What I would want, I think from what we've discussed today, the biggest theme is how important learning history is when you look at any context, but especially when it comes to the Asian American experience, the gendered racialized experience that we deal with. And as allies who are non-Asian, really, while you're learning through the history of imperialism, colonization, the destabilization there, both in the Middle East and in Asia, ask yourself, how have you benefited from that? How have you benefited from imperialism? How have you, specifically, you know, white women, white people, how has that benefited you as it relates to the comfort women issue, as it relates to militarization in Southeast Asia and East Asia. You know, when it comes to like reflecting on your family's history and your ancestors' history, what were the privileges and how were you able to successfully move forward in life compared to the refugees that came here because of that? And really understanding that the concept of freedom and the concept of liberty has been on the backs of slavery, of genocide, of imperialism, of colonization. So how do we grapple with that? So that's something that I really want listeners to take away from, who are allies and wanting to do the work. Everything is connected. This history is your history as well. And if you want to understand Asian American women, you have to learn about it. That's just the only way.
Yes.
Yes. Like no words.
It's like knowledge over friendliness, right? Like
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
and over friendliness and also fun. I think that was like that really stuck out for me earlier. Pam had said something about like how like you can't just do the fun parts of culture or whatnot, right? All of this is very grueling. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. We're not gonna sugarcoat it. It is hard. You can still be friendly, but like,
well, yeah, but I mean, like, let's be friendly and talk about the hard stuff and like,
exactly,
and get
yeah.
super uncomfortable, because it's only in that discomfort that you actually like really learn, understand and seek, like come from a place of understanding and seek to know.
Exactly. Right?
To really know.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That discomfort is where the real conversation starts. It's where real systemic change starts. Yeah. Absolutely.
Can't thank you both enough for coming in today. And like, I'm so happy that we agreed to do this together and that you guys came in and, you know, shared information as well as your personal stories and experiences. Like, I'm so appreciative and thankful to have Conwin as a community partner and the two of you. So
absolutely.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for giving us this platform and this opportunity.
I'm really appreciative for this opportunity to just like, you know, talk off the cuff a little bit, make a few jokes, but ultimately, you know, remind everyone that there's a lot of work to be done.
Thank you all again for your support. I want you to all take good care of each other, and I look forward to continued social justice activism next month.